Macmillan Audio presents The Golden Couple by Greer Hendricks and Sarah Pekkanen. Read for you by Marin Ireland and Carissa Vacker. Part 1. 10 sessions might not seem like nearly enough time to solve complex therapeutic issues, but according to Avery Chambers, her unique brand of intensive short-term counseling changes lives. Her highly controversial process, which some decry as dangerous, is predicated on amplifying core universal emotions such as fear, anger, sadness, and happiness. By pinpointing her client's root issue and using it as a lightning rod to draw in these emotions at high levels, she can slay the demons that plague people, Chambers claims. Among the success stories she lists are clients who have overcome phobias, left emotionally abusive relationships, and changed up their jobs and cities. Each of her 10 sessions has a specific title, and they always follow the same order. But when pressed to reveal more details, Chambers demurs. If my clients know what to expect, my process won't be as effective. I'll only tell you this. It always starts with the confession. Excerpt from DC's Maverick Therapist Profile, copyright The Washington Post Magazine.
Chapter 1. Avery. I never know what to expect when I open my door to new clients. The preliminary phone call only reveals so much. In this case, it came from a woman who introduced herself as Marissa Bishop. "My marriage is in trouble," she began. "I need to talk to my husband about something, but it's a bit complicated. I thought if we came in together..." I'd cut her off there. "I don't want any bias to color my perception before we meet. Plus, the initial communication is for scheduling and security screening only. The actual work doesn't start until the first of our 10 sessions. Still, I gleaned a fair amount of information about Marissa Bishop during our brief conversation. She has money, since she didn't balk at my fee. She's polished and well-spoken, using complete sentences rather than the fragments and fillers people often rely upon in spoken communication. And she's nervous. Her voice wavered. The doorbell chimes, indicating the bishop's arrival, a few minutes late for our 7 p.m. appointment at my home office. "Are evenings okay? My husband works long hours. He has a demanding schedule." "If I decide to work with them, this lack of punctuality won't happen again. I send a quick text to the man I'm seeing later tonight. 8:30 works. Do you have any limes?" I set my phone to silent mode, then tuck the bottle of expensive tequila a client brought me earlier today into my tote bag. Therapists aren't supposed to accept gifts from clients, but I'm not one to follow the rules. I'm also no longer a therapist. I lost my license 5 months ago. I rise and walk to my front door, peering through the peephole before I pull it open. Marissa and Matthew glide across the threshold as if they're accustomed to making an entrance. They're tall and sleek, their blonde hair and classic features a perfect match. He's in a business suit and an overcoat that looks like cashmere. She wears a camel-colored cape that falls to the top of her high-heeled boots. "Welcome, I'm Avery Chambers." I reach out a hand. His grasp is strong and dry. "Matthew Bishop," he replies. I take in his square chin, light blue eyes, and broad shoulders. Then I turn to his wife. I inhale a light floral perfume as I lean forward to shake Marissa's delicate hand. Her fingers are ice cold.
"Sorry, we're a little late. There was traffic," she says as her eyes skitter away from mine.
I lead them to my first floor office, closing the door behind us. Matthew helps his wife off with her cape before he removes his overcoat, hanging them on the wood and brass standing coat rack, then takes a seat on the couch. A confident man, assured of his place in the world. They're not touching, but they sit close enough together that it would be easy for them to do so. They don't look like a couple in trouble, but appearances are often misleading. I pick up a fresh yellow legal pad and pen and claim my usual chair, directly across from them. My home office is uncluttered and comfortable, with a few ficus trees, a deep bay window, and colorful abstract prints on the walls. Back when I worked in a building with other therapists, many of them displayed family photos on their desks, turned inward so as not to distract their patients. My desk was then, and is now, bare. I start the session the way I always do. What brings you here tonight? Marissa wrings her hands, the large diamond on her ring catching the overhead light. Her flawless skin is pale.
I thought...
She coughs, as if her throat is tight. This isn't easy for her. Would you like some water? She manages a smile.
Do you have anything stronger?
She's joking, but I make a quick decision and stand up and retrieve my tote bag. Tequila? I hold up the blue and white patterned bottle. Matthew looks surprised, but recovers quickly. I would have gotten here earlier if I'd known you were serving Clase Azul Reposado. His pronunciation is flawless. I take three of the little plastic cups from my water cooler and fill each with a generous shot. Cheers. I tilt up my cup. A familiar welcome heat fills the back of my throat as I reclaim my seat. Marissa sips hers. She looks more like a white wine kind of woman. But Matthew tosses his back easily.
We are here to talk about Bennett, our son, Matthew says.
He looks at his wife. I don't betray my surprise, even though Marissa didn't mention a child in her initial phone call. She reaches for her husband's hand.
Actually, sweetheart, that isn't exactly why we're here. I need to tell you something.
Her voice quavers again. The shift in the room is palpable. It's as if the temperature plummets. Here it comes, the confession. I wait for it as Matthew stiffens, his features hardening. He doesn't blink as he stares at Marissa.
What's going on?
His wife blindsided him. She lured him to me on false pretenses. Not the best way to begin our work, but maybe it was the only way to get him here.
I've wanted to tell you this for a while. I just didn't know how.
A tear rolls down her cheek.
I broke your trust, and I'm so sorry.
He pulls his hand away roughly.
Cut to the chase, Marissa.
She swallows hard.
I slept with someone, she blurts. Just once, but...
Who?
Matthew's word cuts like a knife through the air. She covers her flat stomach with her hands as if she feels its blade. This won't be the first time I've helped a couple through an infidelity. Back when I was a licensed therapist instead of a consultant, which is my title now, I saw iterations of it nearly every week. The wife who had an affair with a coworker, the husband who cheated with a neighbor, the fiancé who had a fling with an old girlfriend. But something about Marissa's revelation feels different. Or maybe it's Matthew's reaction. Typically, spouses experience shock when confronted with news such as this. Anger doesn't descend until later. Matthew's rage is immediately palpable, though. His hands clench into fists, the plastic cup crumpling in his grasp.
It wasn't anyone you know, Marissa whispers. Just a man I met at Pinnacle Studio.
What? Color floods his cheeks. You fucked a guy from the gym?
She bows her head, as if she feels she deserves his coarse language. I lean forward. It's time for me to re-enter this scene. Matthew, I know how hard it must be for you to hear this. He whirls to look at me with blazing eyes. I lean closer to him, meeting his gaze unflinchingly.
Really? You know? He spits out the words. Were you in on this, helping her set me up to get me here?
I lift up my hands. I'm not going to give him an answer, but I can absorb his rage. I've dealt with angrier men than him. Marissa raises her head.
Matthew, she didn't know why we were coming, and I was scared that if I told you at home...
She doesn't finish her sentence.
My eyes drift to the mangled cup in his hand and wonder if Matthew's emotional outbursts are ever accompanied by physical ones. Matthew stands, towering over his wife. She stares up at him beseechingly. Their body language speaks volumes. She's frightened. What I need to find out is if she's scared of losing her husband or scared of him. I rise unhurriedly to my feet. I don't shout, but my tone carries force. Do you love your wife? Matthew turns to look at me. His face is twisted. Too many emotions are tangled up in his expression for me to determine which one is now dominant. He doesn't answer my question. I maintain eye contact. With men such as Matthew, it's important to demonstrate assertiveness. If you love your wife, I enunciate every word, then please sit back down. I can get you through this. He hovers on the brink of a decision. I could say more to sway him. I could let him know I've worked with many couples who've endured far worse issues than infidelity. I could tell him about my success rate, which is even higher now that I've shed the constraints of traditional therapy and created a new method, one that's all my own. But I don't. I wait him out. I don't see how talking about bullshit like my issues with my father and my dreams can help us get through this, he says. If I had to lay down odds on whether he'll storm back out through the door, I'd put them at 50-50.
Matthew, Marissa begs. Avery's not like that. Please, give this a chance.
He exhales, his rigid shoulders softening. Then he plants himself on the couch, as far from his wife as possible. I reclaim my seat as well. What Matthew doesn't know is that I've just made a decision, too. The bishops intrigue me. I'm going to take them on. Here's how this will go. You have 10 sessions. Knowing the time frame for our work together is essential for a client. What they can't know is my agenda. In my process, each session has a title, beginning with the confession, then cycling through disruption, escalation, revelation, devastation, confrontation, exposure, the test, reconciliation, and concluding with promises. You cannot skip our sessions or be late. No traffic excuses or last-minute deadlines. In between our appointments, you can talk about your son, your careers, the weather, really anything. But it's best if this space remains pure, so I recommend avoiding discussing what will come up here. I also suggest you don't reveal information about our time together to anyone else while our sessions are ongoing. Marissa nods eagerly. I take Matthew's stony silence for acquiescence. There's a hitch in my energy, which I'm careful to mask. All couples have secrets. The bishops are no exception. There's more than just infidelity here. Marissa's cheating is a symptom, not the source of their fundamental breakdown. 12 minutes ago, they breezed into my office, glamorous, affluent, enviable. The golden couple. Now, the underlying tarnishes they've never allowed the public to see are already beginning to show. It's going to get a lot uglier soon.
When do we start? Marissa asks.
We already have.
Chapter 2. Marissa. Marissa feels as if she and Matthew have hurtled off a cliff. They're in free fall. She just spoke the terrible words out loud. I slept with someone. On the drive to Avery Chambers' office in Cleveland Park, D.C., Marissa almost suggested canceling the session. She knew Matthew wouldn't have minded. It had been her idea to schedule the meeting, which she insinuated was to talk about their 8-year-old son, Bennett, who had been bullied by a classmate last year. Marissa reached out to Avery after reading an article in the Washington Post magazine that described Avery's unconventional anti-therapy. The profile contained biographical details about the 41-year-old, She grew up in Chicago, attended Northwestern, is an avid runner, and loves to travel to off-the-beaten-path destinations. Several of her former clients were interviewed. "She literally saved my life," one proclaimed, and so were a few detractors, including the head of the American Psychological Association, who was quoted as saying, "Avery Chambers does not represent or uphold the sacred tenets of our profession." An accompanying photo revealed the silhouette of a woman with a tumble of long hair looking out a window. In person, Avery is more attractive and stylish than Marissa expected, with her radiant olive skin and full lips. She wears a belted green suede dress and 3-inch heels that make her almost as tall as Marissa, and a stack of gold bangles adorns her right wrist. Avery doesn't wear a wedding band. Marissa wonders if this matters. Would it be better if Avery had a husband? Would that enable her to more effectively understand the nuances of a complicated marriage? And certainly, Marissa and Matthew's union is complicated. A decade into their marriage, Matthew, a partner in a DC law firm, spends more evenings at business events than by her side. Marissa feels lost in a constant swirl of activities: running her boutique, Coco, cooking delicious but nutritious meals for her family, staying trim and fit enough to slide into the pair of faded Levi's cutoffs she's had since high school, and serving on the auction committee at Bennett's private school. Avery's voice pulls Marissa into the present. "You need to answer 4 questions, Marissa. Keep it short. 1, have you ever cheated on Matthew before?"
"No, never."
Her whole body is shaking. She's freezing. Normally, Matthew would notice and wrap an arm around her or offer her his suit jacket. She desperately wants to stand up and walk past her husband to get her cape, but it feels perilous to enter his space now. He's blazing with fury. He's the heat to her ice. 2. Avery must sit in that chair day after day, absorbing sordid and sad stories. She is in the epicenter of the rage and pain and disgust ricocheting around the room. It seems impossible that she's immune to it. Yet she looks utterly calm and invincible. "Will it ever happen again?"
"No, I promise."
Avery nods.
3, is it truly over with the other man?
"Yes," Marissa whispers. The moment carries a solemnity. It has the feel of a vow. Matthew finally turns to look at her. There's a sheen in his eyes, just as there was on their wedding day when she walked down the aisle in a cream silk dress with a long train past 200 guests. Avery is studying both of them intently, Marissa realizes. What is she thinking? The silence stretches out.
"What's the 4th question?"
Marissa finally asks.
"That's for Matthew to decide, but not right now. Matthew, when you leave here, I'd like you to think about the essential information you need to know in order to move on."
He nods, just once, but it already feels like progress. Coming here was a good decision. Avery's no-nonsense approach suits Matthew's personality. He likes charts and precise plans. He's a cut-to-the-chase kind of guy. Back when Bennett was being bullied, Marissa tried talking to the other child's parents. Matthew hired a boxing coach to teach their then second grader how to throw an uppercut.
"Let's go back to happier times."
Avery jots something on her notepad.
"Tell me about one of your favorite moments together, Marissa."
There are so many for Marissa to choose from, whole albums of memories. She selects one of the glossy snapshots. "Just last year, Matthew and I were invited to a black tie dinner at the Kennedy Center. It was magical. We hired a car and driver and danced all night. He looked so handsome. It was because of his work on behalf of the World Wildlife Fund that we went..." Avery cuts her off.
"That's an Instagram post. Give me something real."
Marissa flinches. In those few words, Avery has cut to the core of what their marriage has become. Curated moments served up in public, while in private, the emptiness between them slowly expands. Matthew hasn't seemed bothered that their conversations have become more about to-do lists than ideas or feelings, or that their hands no longer find each other during long drives, entwining atop the gear shift. She can't even remember how long ago Matthew began getting out of their bed as soon as the alarm sounded in the morning, instead of reaching for her. "Something real," Marissa repeats. She feels as if she were about to fail a final exam. Then she closes her eyes, and it comes to her. A snowstorm blanketing the city. Her and Matthew at home. Baby Bennett napping. Matthew building a fire while she makes mugs of hot chocolate spiked with rum. The two of them sitting on a chenille blanket playing Scrabble, then abandoning the game to make love.
"It wasn't rum, it was Grand Marnier,"
Matthew says when she finishes. His voice is still hard, but have its edges softened just a little. Avery leans closer to Matthew.
"Now I want a memory from you. I want you to recall some incredible sex you had. Something really steamy."
Marissa lowers her eyes, her cheeks flushing, wondering which moment Matthew will pick. He might not play along. But if he does, will he share the same recollection that bloomed in her mind? That trip to St. Bart's when they snuck into the outdoor cabana in the middle of the afternoon, their bodies slick with suntan lotion and sweat, the taste of salt and coconut on his skin. They hadn't had raw, passionate sex like that in a while. Years, truthfully. Matthew squeezes the crumpled plastic cup in his hand again, making a loud crackling sound.
"I can't think about any good times with Marissa right now."
Avery stands up and retrieves a trash basket from behind her desk. "Let's get rid of those cups." As she returns to her chair, Avery continues.
"And I'm not talking about Marissa."
Marissa's head snaps up in time to catch a smile playing on the edge of Avery's lips.
"I want you to tell me about the greatest sex you had with another woman."
"Are you serious?"
Matthew asks.
"Yes. Your mind is being flooded with ugly images right now. You're imagining your wife with another man. So let's have her think about you with another woman."
Matthew is doing it. Marissa can tell by the way his gaze grows unfocused. She bets she knows exactly whom Matthew is thinking about. Natalie, the woman he dated for a year during college and still maintains a friendship with. Natalie's young daughter attends the same private school as Bennett, and Natalie is the co-chair of the auction committee. She is impossible for Marissa to avoid. However, when Matthew speaks, he shares a different memory.
"Okay, fine. I was a first-year law student, and this hot TA approached me in the library. I was in the stacks, and she snuck up behind me and slid her arms around my waist, under my sweatshirt. We ended up in her apartment. We did it 3 times that night. It's still my record."
Matthew pauses.
"Do you really want me to go on?"
Naturally, Matthew would boil it down to numbers, to a record. He is highly competitive. And for a moment, so is she. She feels like the runner-up. She's never heard this story before. So she and Matthew both kept secrets, she thinks. Avery taps her pen on her pad and seems to make a decision.
"Marissa, would you step out for a few minutes? There's a chair just outside the door where you can sit."
Marissa hesitates, then rises. This appointment is nothing like what she expected. Leaving the two of them alone feels dangerous. As Marissa exits Avery's office, she glances back at her husband, but he isn't looking her way. The wide, wood-planked hallway contains a single upholstered chair next to a table holding a mission-style lamp and vase of red tulips. Marissa is too agitated to sit. She moves closer to the door. She can hear the low rumble of Matthew's voice, but she can't make out a single word. Avery could be asking him anything. Nothing seems out of bounds for her. "Losing my license was the best thing to ever happen to me and to my clients," Avery was quoted as saying in the Post article. Marissa stares at the door. If she pressed her ear against it, just for a minute. Then a thought strikes her. There could be a video camera somewhere. It would be humiliating to be caught. Finally, she pulls out her phone and taps a message to Bennett's babysitter. "All okay. If Bennett wants a brownie, he can have one. I snuck black beans into them, so they're secretly healthy. Smiley face." Just as she finishes, the door to Avery's office opens. Marissa quickly tucks her phone into her bag. "The sitter." Marissa's unsure why she feels the need to explain her actions. "Come back in." Marissa studies Matthew's face as she re-enters the room. It reveals nothing. A lot of times people confess an infidelity because they can't stand the guilt. Avery's tone isn't judgmental or forgiving. She's matter of fact. They do it to ease their own conscience. Is that why you brought your husband here? Marissa thinks carefully about her answer, making sure it is truthful. I wanted to tell Matthew because it was the right thing to do. Avery raises an eyebrow. You two are going to have to put in a lot of work. Marissa nods eagerly. I'll do anything. Beside her on the couch, Matthew is as still as a stone. Marissa wonders if Avery thinks they need more fixing than the average couple with an infidelity issue. Avery asks a few more questions about major stresses they've experienced. Marissa describes the two miscarriages she suffered before having Bennett and the failed fertility treatments they endured afterward. Matthew talks about the death of his mother to leukemia 5 years earlier. Marissa debates mentioning the deep rift between Matthew and his father, a successful DC lobbyist, but she decides not to risk bringing up another upsetting topic. Avery rises. Thursday, same time? Matthew pulls out his iPhone and frowns at the screen.
I've got a client dinner. Getting here will be a pain and—
No problem, Avery says smoothly. Where do you live? Chevy Chase, Marissa replies. Just over the DC line. I'll come to you. 9 p.m.? Matthew blinks in surprise.
Fine.
Marissa isn't getting a vote in this, she realizes, even though she'll be the one cleaning up after dinner and making sure Bennett is asleep early and figuring out logistics such as where they'll sit and whether it's appropriate to serve drinks or food. Keep Monday and Thursday evenings at 7 p.m. free for the next few weeks, Avery instructs them. Avery already seems to know how to handle Matthew. He's nodding, responding to her succinct instructions. Which means Avery probably also has a strategy for managing her, Marissa thinks.
Chapter 3. Avery. The sky is pitch black as I veer left onto Connecticut Avenue and head toward home, reaching for the bottle of water in my cup holder to rinse the sour taste of tequila from my mouth. The DC roads are quieter at this time of night, or technically, early morning, with just a few people straggling in and out of the bars and restaurants that line either side of the street. Most residents are asleep, including Derek, the man I just left. His scent lingers on my skin. Derek's cologne is too woodsy for my taste. If I were planning to have a long-term relationship with him, I might give him a bottle of my favorite brand, but neither of us is looking for a commitment. Still, the hours I just spent with him are among the most pleasurable I've passed all week. At 26, Derek has retained the powerful physique and athleticism that earned him a full scholarship to the University of Maryland, where he served as a tight end on an undefeated team. Unlike a lot of good but not great college ball players, Derek never labored under the illusion that he'd turn pro. After graduation, he found a job with a company that sells state-of-the-art security systems, ones that are much more expensive and comprehensive than those typically purchased by homeowners. I met him fairly recently when he came to my house to install mine. My phone buzzes with an incoming text just as I reach my Cleveland Park neighborhood. I don't dig into my purse to read it. It could be Derek checking to see if I've made it home safely, or my stepdaughter, Lana, who has a fickle relationship with time. It could also be my mother, letting me know she's extending her stay at the South Indian ashram where she's been ensconced for the past 2 months. I finish off the water in my bottle and turn onto my street. My gut clenches as I realize something is off. My house is too dark. The lamp on the table just inside my front door should be shining brightly. It's set on a timer precisely so I don't have to enter a shadowy home. Just a few months ago, I would have blithely gone into the darkness. Now I slowly pull into the driveway, my headlights illuminating my front porch. The wooden swing is swaying ever so slightly in the wind, but there's no other sign of movement. I've got mace on my keychain, My bushes are cut too low to provide cover for anyone, and my alarm system is almost impossible to override. Still, I leave on the car engine and keep my headlights blazing while I step out of my old BMW and approach my front door, reaching into my purse for my phone. My neighbors are close by on either side, but their places are also dark, and on a cold night in mid-March, no one is likely to have a window open. The bottom porch step creaks as I step onto it. I reach my doorknob and test it. The lock is still engaged. I twist a key into it, then unlock the deadbolt. When I give the door a little push, it soundlessly glides open. I wait a moment, listening hard. I can't sense a presence inside. A table in my foyer holds a vase of red tulips, a shallow glass bowl, and the lamp. Down the hall to the left is my office. The living room is to the right. I click the switch on the lamp, the sharp, sudden noise seeming to echo through the house. When it doesn't come to life, I twist it again. Nothing. I touch my index finger to the bulb. It's warm. I unscrew it and gently shake it, hearing the telltale rattle that indicates it burned out. Sometimes the simplest explanation is the correct one, but I can no longer risk making those kinds of assumptions. I flick on the overhead hall light, then walk back to my car to turn off the engine. My phone buzzes again as I re-enter my house, and I instinctively glance down. A text lands on my screen. "Please, it's an emergency." Directly above it is the message that came in while I was driving. "Sorry to bother you, but could you call me?" They're both from Cameron, one of my first 10-session clients. Cameron is a sweet, shy 32-year-old who completed his work with me last fall. Cameron came to see me because he was having panic attacks. His first session confession was clear, even though he didn't explicitly state it. He was miserable in his marriage. His wife, Skylar, was a controlling, narcissistic woman who wanted to completely dominate Cameron. Cameron's life changed radically as a result of our work together. So did mine. The last time I heard from him, he'd moved out and was enjoying life on his own in an apartment. After I slip off my boots and hang up my coat, I call him. He picks up before the first ring ends. "Avery?" His voice is frantic. "Skylar found out I was dating someone and tried to kill herself. She took a bunch of pills and called me to say goodbye." I'm not all that surprised, but I don't mention this to Cameron. "Where are you now?" I ask as I climb the stairs and enter my bedroom.
"Sibley Hospital."
I peer into the mirror over my bureau and frown, wiping smeared mascara from beneath my eyes. I'm exhausted and it's after midnight, but I pull a sweater and jeans out of a drawer. "I'll be right there." Other people's issues are so much easier to fix than my own. Cameron sits on a bench just outside the hospital entrance, his shock of red hair and familiar army green puffer jacket, the one that's a size too big, making him immediately recognizable. Keeping my pace steady and unhurried, I walk toward him, my exhalations forming little white puffs in the frigid night air. As I draw closer, I notice one of his shoelaces is untied. I resist the urge to lace it up for him. With tears streaking his open, innocent face and a smattering of freckles across his nose and cheeks, he looks young enough to still be in high school. "It's going to be fine," I put my hand on his shoulder. "Come on, let's go inside." He rises and follows me as I step onto a mat that triggers the automatic doors and we enter the ER. Only one other person, a middle-aged man sitting in a plastic bucket seat staring at his phone, is in the waiting area. As I lead Cameron toward a sofa, I think about how I'm going to manage this temporary setback. A meek man with an oppressive, manipulative ex is a toxic mix.
"Maybe I shouldn't have told her I started dating someone," Cameron collapses onto the couch.
"Let's take a step back. You're still helping Skylar out financially, right?"
"Yes, I'm paying half the mortgage until the house sells, and sometimes I go by if she needs help with stuff."
"Stuff?"
Yeah, like if something goes wrong around the house. I told her to call me instead of dealing with it herself because once she got up on a chair to open this window that was stuck and she fell. She only got a few bruises, but it could have been worse. Convenient, I refrain from saying. Maybe it was all too abrupt. Cameron's lower lip trembles. That's exactly what Skylar wants you to believe. She didn't intend to kill herself. Cameron flinches.
How do you know that?
Look, if Skylar really wanted to die, she wouldn't have phoned you. While a suicide attempt is usually a cry for help, in Skylar's case, I can say with near certainty it's an attempt to regain some control over Cameron. Right now, my former client is more of a danger to himself than Skylar is to herself, and I need to shock him straight. So what do you think the solution is, Cameron? Give up your new life and move back in with Skylar? Exhilaration courses through my veins. Casting aside the filters that constrained me when I was a therapist is so deliciously freeing. I lean in closer to him. I'm fond of Cameron. He has as tender and pure a heart as anyone I've ever met. There will always be something with her. And if you give in now, in another few months, you'll be right back where you were before. I'm reaching him. I can see it in his slower breathing and in his increased eye contact.
What should I do?
A traditional therapist would gently help Cameron find his own solution, even if it took years. Even if it was the wrong one. You need to tell Skylar you're sorry she's hurting, but it isn't going to change anything.
I want to, but...
The longer you wait, the harder it's going to be. Cameron's ex-wife is a powerful force in his life. I need to be stronger. I stand up and stretch out my hand. Let's go. You're not doing this alone. He hesitates, then rises and follows me to the security guard manning the desk. I tell the guard we're here to see Skylar Sullivan, and we present our driver's licenses and sign in. A nurse appears a few moments later and leads us to Skylar, who lies on a gurney with curtain walls separating her from the patients on either side. Her dark hair is spread out over the white pillowcase, and I notice she's wearing an awful lot of makeup.
Skylar, Cameron says softly.
Her eyelids flutter open.
Cameron, she whispers. I knew you'd come.
She stretches out a hand, leaving her manicured fingers dangling midair until he moves closer and takes them. She doesn't notice me. Her sole focus is on Cameron. I pick up the chart at the foot of Skylar's bed and scan the notes. She swallowed 20 milligrams of Lunesta, a sedative. Not enough to kill her. She didn't even need to have her stomach pumped. Just enough to give her ex a bad scare.
You know I hate hospitals. Skylar's voice trembles. Will they let you take me home?
I don't think you'll be able to leave tonight.
Her face falls.
But when I do, you'll be there, right? You'll stay with me.
This is it. The moment when my 10 sessions will collide with his ex-wife's force of will.
No.
Cameron swallows hard and releases her hand.
I have my own apartment now.
She inhales sharply.
But I'm not well. I need you.
As I put down the chart, Skylar's head swivels toward me. I see recognition come into her eyes.
What is she doing here?
Skylar's eyes narrow.
Get out, or I'm calling the cops again.
A machine beeps shrilly, and by the time the same nurse who led Cameron and me to Skylar opens the curtain, I'm already backing out of the makeshift room. You feeling okay, Skylar? The nurse checks the machine's screen. Your blood pressure and pulse just shot up. I hope Skylar will be kept here for another day or two. In the meantime, I'll email Cameron another snippet of the video clip I've created. The one that features a zoom in on Skylar's furious, pinched face as she berates him with vicious words. I showed Cameron that video during our fourth session together, the one I've titled Revelation. Seeing and hearing his wife disparage him as he cowered on the couch, unshackled something in Cameron. It saved him. Sometimes we need to look at our lives from a different angle to recognize the dysfunction and damage certain relationships are causing. When Cameron saw, truly saw, for the first time, how abusive Skylar was to him, he began to gather the courage to move out. That video also cost me my license. I'd snuck into Cameron and Skylar's house in D.C. to record it. Neither of them knew I was hiding in a closet, filming the argument I'd instructed Cameron to stoke. When Skylar found out by hacking into Cameron's emails, she reported me. Luckily, Cameron told the police he'd given me permission to enter his home and film him, which means the criminal charges didn't stick. Only the professional repercussions did. So in a way, that video freed me too. Back in the hospital's waiting room, I pause at the water cooler by the guard's desk. A night of tequila and sex has left me parched, and the dry hospital air isn't helping. I pull a plastic cup out of the dispenser sleeve and fill it, gulping it down without pause. Then I fill it again. When I toss the cup into the trash bin, it lands atop a pile of others, including one that someone crushed. I stare at it for a moment, remembering Matthew's hand closing tightly around the cup I gave him. Then I head back outside. My BMW is right where I left it in the parking lot, beneath a tall, bright lamp, but I still glance into my back seat before unlocking my door. It's one of my newer habits, along with requesting a picture ID from prospective clients and making sure they match the photos before I let them into my house. Skylar isn't my only enemy. It takes a minute for the heat to come on, and I'm already driving toward Matthew and Marissa's house by the time the blowing air has chased the chill from my body. Clients reveal only so much when they come to see me. I want to get a fuller picture of the Bishops, and I'm wide awake, so I might as well start now. They live in Chevy Chase, just over the DC line in Maryland, an area where even a small plot of undeveloped land can go for seven figures. Their home is exactly as I expected, grand and sprawling with a beautifully maintained lawn, enclosed by a tall wrought iron fence and gate. It's easy to imagine Marissa clipping flowers from the garden in a wide-brimmed hat while Matthew tosses a baseball to his son, and to picture them on their graceful front porch, sipping cocktails as the sun dips lower into the sky. Only one thing is off, and it's the inverse of what occurred just an hour or so ago when I arrived home to discover my house was unexpectedly dark. At nearly 2 o'clock a.m., the Bishop's place should be cloaked in shadows and completely still. But a glow illuminates one of the second-story rooms. I squint and glimpse the form of a person moving around inside. Which one of them can't sleep? Insomnia can grip us for many reasons. Stress, guilt, fear, and rage are among them. An uneasy mind is difficult to quiet.
Chapter 4. Marissa. Marissa winces as the empty glass shatters against the terracotta tiles of the kitchen floor. Damn, she mutters, grabbing a paper towel and bending down to pick up the shards. Too much coffee and too little sleep have made her jittery.
Mom, Bennett says, that's a dollar for the curse jar.
Technically, she feels the word is only a borderline swear, but she isn't going to debate this with her 8-year-old. She scans the floor, knowing she has probably missed a few sharp slivers as she hears the rush of water abruptly cease one floor up. On typical mornings, Matthew showers while she applies moisturizer and makeup, the two of them discussing the day's logistics, whether he'd be home for dinner that night, or if they should repaint the dining room. Ever since their session with Avery, though, her husband has been sleeping in the guest room and avoiding the master bathroom until she is downstairs. Marissa reaches for another glass and fills it with freshly squeezed grapefruit juice, then glances at the spelling list on the counter. Song, Marissa prompts Bennett, who sits atop a kitchen stool, eating Kashi cereal topped with fresh blueberries, which he seems to be pushing aside with his spoon.
S-O-N-G.
Perfect. Marissa turns the turkey bacon sizzling on the stove. How about strong? She keeps quizzing Bennett on the ONG words as she sprinkles a quarter cup of grated Gruyere in the omelet she is preparing. Usually breakfasts such as these are reserved for Matthew's birthday, Father's Day, and the occasional lazy Sunday. But this is the third day of her efforts to make amends. It has been easy to follow Avery's instructions and avoid talking about their session because Matthew has barely been home. She hopes his silent fury is beginning to burn out. Wrong, Marissa prompts Bennett as Matthew's footsteps approach the kitchen. Marissa slides the omelet onto a plate alongside three slices of bacon and sets it down on the counter, then turns to greet her husband. Good morning.
Hey, guys.
Matthew's voice is jovial, but he turns his back to her as he ruffles Bennett's hair.
I'm driving you in today, kiddo. Run and grab your backpack.
You are? Marissa asks as Matthew grabs a single slice of bacon. She always takes their son to school. Matthew doesn't even know the carpool rules. You need to drop him off at the south.
We'll figure it out. I'll wait for him in the car.
Bennett reappears in his coat with the backpack that always looks so big on his narrow shoulders. She hugs him, holding on a moment longer than usual and breathing in the scent of the tangerine vanilla shampoo she just started carrying in her boutique. Bye, she calls out, watching as he climbs into the back seat of Matthew's Land Rover. During the 10 seconds her husband spent in her presence, the welcoming ambiance she'd carefully cultivated, the brewing coffee, the bouquet of violet hydrangeas on the counter, was irrevocably altered. I love you, she says, even though she knows neither of them can hear her. Marissa remains perfectly still at the window in the suddenly silent kitchen, watching until the car disappears from view. 20 minutes later, Marissa slides her key into the lock of her boutique and the door glides open. She steps inside Coco and inhales a slow, grounding breath. The landscape of her personal life is jagged and frayed, but all the pieces in this intimate, elegant space are in place. Located just a few miles from their home, across the DC line, the boutique carries a medley of luxury goods. Everything from antimicrobial cushioned yoga mats to baby-soft cashmere hoodies, items her customers didn't even know they needed until they became cherished possessions. She can hear her lone employee, Polly, in the back room, unpacking the boxes, which arrive several times a week from far-flung locations, containing hand-painted trays from Santa Fe, or wildflower honey from Vermont, or fragrant bath salts from Paris. Usually, Marissa doesn't get into the boutique until after 9 a.m., but Matthew's surprise declaration left her with an extra 45 minutes that would have been spent taking Bennett to school. She'd felt too unmoored to stay in their home alone. Marissa hired Polly just a month or so ago, after her former assistant accepted a managerial job at Saks. Polly opens and closes the shop almost every day, which allows Marissa to be on site only during the time that Bennett is in school. Marissa knows being able to craft her own schedule is a luxury, but it isn't as idyllic as it sounds. She still has to respond to emails at all hours, especially because many of her suppliers are in different time zones, and she often attends to ancillary tasks, such as following up on delayed shipments or uploading new photos to the store's website or Instagram from the bleachers of Bennett's baseball games or in the early morning when she's the only one awake in the house. In a sense, she's always on call. Marissa moves an antique perfume bottle an inch to the right as she passes a display table, calling out, Good morning, Polly. Marissa! Polly steps out of the back room, holding a mug of tea with a red and white striped paper straw. You're here early. We finally got in those gorgeous hurricane globes, but two are broken. Wonderful, Marissa rolls her eyes. How difficult is it to wrap things properly? I'm sorry, should I send them back? Polly looks stricken, as if it were her fault. No, I'll handle it. Sorry, rough morning. Ignore me, I'm grumpy. Everything okay? I just didn't sleep well. Well, you look awesome, as always. Love your shirt. Marissa gazes down at her navy blue blouse. She's forgotten what she's wearing. Thanks, Matthew gave it to me for Christmas. Polly is young and eager, and usually Marissa welcomes Polly's many questions, knowing she wants to learn the ropes. Marissa doesn't mind explaining the ins and outs of owning a small business, but today she craves quiet.
The second session with Avery is tonight, and Marissa can think of little else. Just before she left the house, she sent Matthew a text reminding him, but he hasn't replied. What if he doesn't come home in time? Should I change up the window display? Polly abruptly tips her head and untucks her hair from behind her ears in a strange, jerky motion. Sure, let's do something cute with the bathrobes and slippers. Marissa already has a vision in her mind. She'll let Polly give it a shot, then she'll tweak it. But for once, Polly isn't peppering Marissa with questions. She's still fiddling with her long brown hair. I'll get started. Polly starts to spin around, and that's when Marissa notices the distinctive chunky gold and onyx earrings Polly is wearing. Earrings that adorned Marissa's own earlobes just yesterday. She'd taken them off and left them on her desk when her AirPods died, and she'd had to press her cell phone to her ear. Polly, are those my... You left them here? Polly blurts, a cherry-colored flush spreading across her fair skin. I'm sorry, I was worried they'd get lost. I thought I'd hold them for you. I see. The earrings are pierced. It feels a little gross that Polly slid them into her lobes. It would have been easy for her to simply put them aside in a safe place. Polly removes the earrings and holds them out in her palm, casting her big brown eyes toward the floor. Marissa takes the jewelry, making a mental note to sanitize the pieces before wearing them again. Okay, let's see what you come up with for the window, Marissa says briskly. I've got to make a few calls. I'll come look when I'm done. As Polly heads toward the front of the store, Marissa walks into the tiny kitchen and makes herself a cup of ginger chai, pulling a paper straw from the supply drawer. She'd taught Polly the trick of using one to not only preserve lipstick, but avoid staining your teeth. Marissa settles in at her desk, attending to emails and calls. She has just hung up with the candlestick vendor when her phone buzzes with an incoming text. The name on the screen electrifies her.
You doing okay?
He isn't supposed to be texting her. She'd told him they both had to forget their illicit night ever occurred. It was a mistake. It can't ever happen again, she'd said the next morning when he'd phoned. She should be annoyed that he's continuing to reach out. But she's strangely touched. The truth is, she hasn't been able to erase the memory of their time together. The first time she noticed him, really noticed him, she was drawn to his physicality, his strong shoulders and biceps flexing as he lifted and pulled. He'd turned and smiled at her with a boyish grin that let her know he'd caught her watching. She stares down at her phone, willing herself to ignore his message. Three dots appear, almost as if he knows she is looking, waiting to see what he'll write next.
I know I shouldn't say this, but I can't stop thinking about our night.
She hasn't stopped thinking about it either. Still, if she could undo it, she would. She'd give quite a lot for it never to have happened. Yet something unexpected is woven into Marissa's shame and regret, a deep thread of warmth that comes from the sensation of feeling cherished. Of being truly seen. It wasn't just raw sex between them. His kisses were slow and tender, and he held her afterward, seemingly reluctant to let her go. Marissa, he'd whispered, his voice husky. Marissa? She flinches and looks behind her. Polly stands there, holding a fresh cup of tea just inches away, close enough, perhaps, to have read the screen of Marissa's phone. Marissa flips it over in her hand, feeling her heart pound. You startled me. Marissa stands up and takes a step away from her desk. I'm sorry. Polly's usually easy to read, but Marissa can't tell from Polly's expression whether she glimpsed those incriminating lines on the phone. I just wanted to let you know the window display is done. I think you'll like it. Marissa wants to push back. Her needy young assistant is grating on her. Polly takes a sip of the ginger chai that Marissa favors, and Polly has recently proclaimed to be her own favorite. The shirt she's wearing is tucked in the front and left loose in the back, the same way Marissa always wears her shirts. It never annoyed Marissa until now. I'll be there in a minute, Marissa says firmly. Okay. Polly skitters away, and Marissa quickly deletes the messages. It's 10 a.m., time for Coco to open. Marissa selects one of her Spotify playlists, and Chris Martin's voice croons through the speakers. She walks to the front of the store and looks at Polly's display.
It's exactly what Marissa asked for. Two cozy his and her robes draped over a tufted chair with matching slippers set out. Polly has added a life-size decorative silver pug dog atop a rug and a pair of chunky painted mugs on a little glass table. Anyone would want to sink into that scene. Marissa stares at it. She feels Polly's eager eyes on her. She swears she can hear Polly's excited breaths. Polly is standing too close to her again. Her presence makes Marissa feel itchy. Good effort, but it isn't quite right. As soon as the words come out, Marissa regrets them, but not enough to try to smooth them over.
Chapter 5. Avery. I collapse onto the grass, gasping. Romeo flops down beside me, his tongue lolling out, his stubby tail thumping the air. You're not even winded, are you? Show off. He rolls over, exposing his pink stomach for a scratch. I comply. Such a good boy. I can't help it. I'm a sucker for dogs, especially ones such as Romeo, who no longer have any reason to trust humans, but continue to do so. It's a crisp 40-degree day, but clumps of tourists mill around the grassy National Mall stretching between the Washington Monument and the U.S. Capitol. It's my favorite loop to run. For the past few months, ever since I completed the requisite volunteer training, I've been stopping by the animal shelter on my drive here to pick up a jogging buddy. The shelter's director always finds me a dog who needs the activity. At first, I ran with a Labrador mix, then a handsome gray dog who was part Whippet. Those two were quickly adopted. For 6 weeks straight, my dates have been with Romeo, a pit bull. He's a lover, not a fighter, which is why he was dumped here, the shelter director told me. But we can't find him a home. People take one look at him and move on to the next crate. Romeo does look fierce, with his powerful jaws, muscular body, docked ears, and scarred face. But inside, he's a marshmallow. My breathing slows as he leans against me, and I soak in his welcome warmth. Then I glance down at my watch and see it's almost noon. I'm going to be late if I don't hurry. I reluctantly stand up and stretch my tight calves, then give Romeo's leash, the bright yellow one with the hopeful words, "Adopt me," printed on it in black letters, a tug. He dutifully pads to my parked car, slurps up the water I pour into a collapsible bowl, then hops into the passenger's seat for the ride back to the shelter. I've grown to hate having to return Romeo to his kennel, even though the shelter is a clean, pleasant space staffed by big-hearted volunteers. One of them tosses a rawhide bone into Romeo's cage when we arrive. Romeo walks obediently inside. He curls up on his worn bed in the corner and stares at me through the metal bars with limpid brown eyes, ignoring the bone. "Come on, that looks delicious," I say as I head toward the exit. I hear a little whimper. I turn around. "I'll be back in a week." He drops his head onto his paws, his gaze never wavering. I swear I can feel the sadness of the dog who wouldn't fight back, even to protect himself, for the entertainment of despicable people. This is a terrible idea. I go find the shelter's director to tell her I want to adopt Romeo. On my drive home, I blast the Indigo Girls and make a mental list of the supplies I will need for Romeo when I pick him up tomorrow. Bowls, a new leash, toys, kibble. I find myself smiling as I imagine Romeo's nails clicking on my hardwood floors as he follows me around my house, and him snoozing by my side as I write up client notes. Then I picture him chewing on my favorite leather pumps. As I pull into my driveway, I see my stepdaughter, Lana, sitting in the driver's seat of her Honda parked behind the old Mercedes that her dad used to drive. I turn off my engine and step out as she mirrors my movements. "Sorry I'm late," I stretch out my arms. "It's okay, I just got here." As we hug, I notice a streak of pink paint in her hair. Lana runs kids' birthday parties at a decorate-your-own pottery store. "Princess theme?" I touch a chocolate brown curl. She inherited her thick locks from her dad, along with his love of roller coasters and Monty Python and aversion to mayonnaise. Lana and her cerebral, intense father had little else in common, though. I unlock my front door and gesture for Lana to come in. She still has a key, since Paul shared custody with his ex-wife after their divorce, and Lana lived with us part-time as a teenager. But she stopped using it when she graduated from college and moved into a nearby apartment. It could have been a disastrous mix, a 13-year-old girl and her father's new wife cohabitating under one roof. But Lana and I formed a bond that's all our own. Want some coffee? At her nod, I drop a pod into the Keurig and reach into the cupboard for the box of almond biscotti. I crunch into one as I lead Lana into the living room. Two packing boxes are stacked by the fireplace, containing memorabilia Paul stored in the basement. When my husband died, he left his generous life insurance policy to Lana, and he willed our home to me. I got rid of a few things immediately, such as his containers of medicines and the hospital-style bed that we'd set up in Lana's old bedroom so he could have the brightest room in the house. We'd tried to offset the grimness of all the medical supplies by erecting a trio of bird feeders just outside the windows so Paul could watch the fluttering of blue jays, finches, and soft brown sparrows. We'd also covered the walls with family photographs of Paul, Lana, and me in happier times, and brought in his vintage Crosley turntable so he could hear his beloved jazz music. It took me a little while to box up Paul's clothes and donate them to a homeless shelter. Now, just a few of Paul's belongings still occupy our rooms, including his vast DVD collection of black and white movies, hundreds of records to go with his turntable, and books ranging from the classics to spy thrillers. Sometimes when I walk by his office, I almost expect him to swivel around in his black leather chair, calling out, "Love?" in the British accent that won me over the first time we met, when I went to Politics and Prose to attend his book signing. These boxes represent another layer of clearing away. They're filled with Paul's academic awards, old letters, photographs, and Lana's childhood artwork. "Take anything you want," I tell Lana. She sinks onto the carpet and crosses her legs, but she doesn't reach into the top box. I study her face. "You okay, sweetie?" She sighs. "I just miss him so much." If Lana were one of my clients, I'd open the box myself and hand her the first item. But instead, I hug her. "If you're not up for this, we can do it another time." "No, no, I'm fine." She sucks in a deep breath, then lifts up a flap and pulls out a big padded envelope filled with loose photographs. She begins flipping through them, Lana sitting on a spotted pony, blowing out six blazing candles atop a pink frosted cake, standing in between her parents, beaming through a mouthful of braces at what must have been her junior high school graduation. My eyes linger on that photo. It was taken shortly before I met Paul. Neither he nor his ex-wife is wearing a wedding ring in the picture. Paul's hair was still a riot of dark curls back then, with just a few strands of silver glinting in the temples. He was tan and fit, strong enough to scoop me up in his arms and carry me to bed on our wedding night. So different from the frail man who I held in my arms as he took his final breath 8 months ago. Marianne, Lana's mother, stands on the other side of her daughter, looking as if she smells something sour, an expression I've come to associate with her. "How's your mom?" I ask. "Oh, you know, the same." Lana's eyes flit away from mine. Marianne and Paul separated long before he and I met, but Marianne never liked the idea of him with someone else, let alone someone who was nearly two decades younger. Years after he and I wed, Lana confessed to me that her mother still referred to me as her. Deeper in the box are first edition copies of Paul's three books, all bestsellers. I've saved copies for myself, too. Lana flips open his debut, titled You, Me, and the Couch, and stares at the dedication. "For Lana, my precious daughter." She runs her fingertip over the words, and we both blink back tears. The sight of the book is transporting me back to the first time I ever glimpsed Paul. He was standing behind a podium, microphone in hand, enthralling the crowd that filled every seat in the Politics and Prose bookstore. I was 24, attending grad school at George Washington University to get my master's degree in social work, and I walked in late for Paul's reading. I wasn't good at setting boundaries back then, and I'd allowed one of the clients at my internship to overstay his session. Paul's gaze met mine as the door closed behind me. "Sorry," I'd mouthed. I'd read a few of his articles, and I admired his insights into the complexities of the human mind, as well as his dexterity with language, but I was unprepared for his physical magnetism. His eyes, still holding mine, crinkled as he spoke his next words. "That's when the police came rushing in to arrest my patient, who tried to hide behind me, as if a rumpled psychiatrist was any defense against a SWAT team. Bloody hell, did he think I'd whack at them with my reading glasses?" That accent. His fierce intelligence, his graceful movements, and the elegant yet strong-looking hands that gripped the pen when he signed my book. "To Avery, I can already tell you'll make a brilliant therapist." I emailed him a week later. It was easy to find his contact information through his office, and I had a legitimate question about one of the cases he'd described in his book. At least, that's what I told myself. We fell into a correspondence that felt natural and exhilarating. I instinctively knew I had to be the one to ask him out because of our age difference. So, one night after a couple glasses of wine, I carefully crafted a note suggesting we meet for coffee or a drink. I closed my eyes as I pressed the key to send it. Our first date was 24 hours later. Within 6 months, I'd moved into his home, located in a comfortable, eclectic neighborhood not far from the National Zoo. Lana sets down her dad's book, breaking my reverie. I take a sip of coffee while she looks through old letters she wrote to Paul from sleepaway camp, reading aloud a few funny bits. I'm about to suggest that we make lunch together when her phone rings. Her face lights up. "Sorry, it's this guy I've been seeing. Take it." I get up to go into the kitchen to give her privacy. I check the contents of my refrigerator to see what I can cobble together, but the items aren't inspiring. A half dozen eggs, baby carrots, a bottle of Dom Perignon, slightly wilted lettuce, and leftover quesadillas from my favorite Tex-Mex place. "Avery?" Lana pokes her head in as I'm suspiciously sniffing a container of hummus. Her voice is different, higher and airy. "Sorry, but I've got to run. Greg got off work early and I need to pick him up." "Ooh," I give her a playful poke in the ribs. "Who's Greg? Come on, tell me while I help you pack up your car." As we load the boxes into the trunk of her Honda, I learn Greg works at the hardware store a few doors down from the pottery shop, and they met on a lunch break last week. "We both ordered the same veggie sandwich," she exclaims as she hops into her car. Her eyes are now sheened with excitement instead of tears. At the moment, picking up a guy she's just met has eclipsed everything else of importance to her. Lana doesn't always have the best instincts when it comes to men. Before I can share her happiness over her new relationship, I need to meet Greg. I extract a promise from her to bring him by soon, then lean in through the open window and give her a kiss. She roars away over the speed limit as I re-enter my house. With the boxes gone, I have only one more area to clean out. I should be getting some work done. I want to check in on Cameron and research Bishop Sims and Chapman, the corporate law practice founded by Matthew Bishop and two partners, but I've postponed this particular task for far too long already. I climb the steps to Paul's study and sink into his big chair. His long wooden desk used to be cluttered with papers and journals and a decorative jar filled with pens and our framed wedding photo. Paul tended to get messy when he lost himself in work. Now it's bare, as mine is, just one floor below. I pull out Paul's deep middle desk drawer. It's filled with letters and cards, most handwritten, a few printed out, some in somber cream envelopes and others in pastels. There must be 100 of them. Every one of them is addressed to me. I pick up a handful. They feel heavy with the weight of the written sentiments inside. I let the envelopes slide through my fingers into the trash basket. I glimpse a few familiar names on the return addresses, one of Paul's favorite colleagues, another from my grad school roommate, as they fall. I grab another handful, then another, sending them tumbling through the air into the trash until no more remain. Following Paul's funeral, I'd intended to write back to every sympathy note that arrived, but I never even opened them. How could I respond to people who wrote about my terrible loss, my unimaginable pain, and exhorted me to remember that even though it might seem impossible, time would heal all of my wounds? The complicated truth, which I've never revealed to anyone, is that I stopped loving my husband long before he passed away. Paul was passionate and dynamic at first. I attributed his occasional withdrawals as being a necessary component of his work. His patients were demanding, and he had to remain keenly alert and focused all day. He operated at a high level. He required solitude and quiet to concentrate on his research and writing at night. As the years passed, his need to be alone grew more intense. His absences, both emotional and physical, became harder to excuse. Naturally, we tried therapy. Every week for a solid year, we sat side by side on a couch in Dr. Friedman's office, fighting to bridge the chasm between us. I attempted to be more understanding. Paul vowed to make more of an effort to engage emotionally with me. Neither of us succeeded. We ended therapy, and I turned my focus toward ending my marriage. I'd rent a little place in Georgetown, something near the vibrant intersection of Wisconsin Avenue and M Street. I'd keep the office space I shared with three other therapists. My commute would be a little bit longer, but I'd make it work. Paul and I would remain cordial. Lana and I would remain close. I'd begin dating, a prospect that filled me with excitement. I'd just begun to look for an apartment when I was jarred awake late one night by the incessant shriek of the tea kettle. "Turn it off, Paul," I thought irritably. When he didn't, I groggily made my way downstairs to the brightly lit kitchen, where Paul lay on the tiled floor, a carton of Half and Half spilled beside him. "A seizure," an impossibly young-looking doctor with blue-framed glasses told me. But that was a symptom. The root cause was an aggressive brain tumor. Paul lived for another 9 months. Visiting nurses handled most of his medical care. At night, Paul and I reclaimed our companionship by watching his beloved old movies, as well as comedies such as Schitt's Creek and The Office. His life was ending. Mine was on hold. I didn't mourn my husband when he died. I'd already come to terms with losing him. I finally felt free.